Dear friends, this is Pastor Ron Poach, and I want to take a few moments and introduce the speaker on this tape to which you'll be listening. We recently had a three-day conference in Phoenix with Lindsay Williams. Lindsay is the author of three books, The Energy Non-Crisis, To Seduce a Nation, and now a new book, Syndrome of Control. Mr. Williams is a leader in the freedom movement in America today, and through preaching the Word of God, he's exposing the international world controllers, and in doing so, perhaps it's not too late for us to act responsibly, and with God's help, we can get our republic back again. God bless you and give you ears to hear and eyes to see is my prayer. Now, you may order the book, Syndrome of Control, from America's Promise, Lord's Covenant Church, and we urge you to do so. And now, Lindsay Williams.
I'm glad you're here tonight, and welcome. It's good to see such a good audience. We are in the process now of preparing the manuscript for a fourth book, and it's going to be dealing with the farm crisis. You do realize, of course, that every 6 minutes, a family farm is going into bankruptcy, every 6 minutes, and that within less than 2 years' time, you will feel it on the grocery store shelves in Phoenix, Arizona, and there could very well be a food shortage and hunger in America in less than 2 years' time. Well, that story is so drastic, until we have a camera crew here tonight videoing this session, we'll also be videoing it tomorrow afternoon and Sunday, who have produced one of the most amazing videos on the farm situation I've ever known. And David Smith, David is right here at this camera, and David, we appreciate the great job you've done. And tomorrow afternoon, we will be showing the outstanding, professionally produced videotape entitled Torn from the Land. This is the first time I believe it's ever been shown in your city. It's 45 minutes in length, and that'll be in the session on tomorrow afternoon. So be sure that you bring some other friends along with you, and it'll be a lecture as well as information time, as well as one of the most outstanding videos that I think has been produced in the Patriot field in the past few years' time. So that's tomorrow afternoon. Be sure that you're here from 1 until 3. 3 hours of seminar that I think you're going to find very interesting. Now, tonight is going to be different. I have never done before what I'm going to do tonight. I normally am a lecturer. I stand here, have my notes, give it piece by piece, and the audience, of course, responds and so on. Tonight is different. I have never done this before. I hope it's going to work out. May I say that you're probably one of the most watched audiences around this evening, because I'm going to be watching your response to a brand new type of presentation. The material I'm giving tonight has never been given anywhere in public in the United States of America before. The first time it was ever given over the air was at the Southwest Radio Church when I pre-recorded 4 30-minute sessions on yesterday in Oklahoma City. It will be aired nationwide in the very near future. What I'm giving tonight is startling. I hope that you are partially knowledgeable. I hope that you at least know somewhat of the fact that there is a plot for the destruction of your freedom. Otherwise, what is being said tonight could be very, very dangerous to your mental thought patterns, if I may say. The thing that I'm giving, I'll explain in just a moment, but I think I must feel about like the gentleman who always bragged about being able to kill the biggest bear in the world. In fact, he told everybody in his city that he had killed the biggest bear that had ever been killed in that whole part of New Mexico. In fact, he said, no one's ever killed a bigger bear than what I've killed in New Mexico. Well, the boys at the office decided that he was just bragging. So they decided they'd take him up on his brag, and they told him one day, they said, all right, we're going to pay for the cabin up in the mountains this year. And when bear season comes around, we're all going. You're going to go out and get the first bear. And when you bring him back, then we'll go hunting. But we want to see if you can do what you say you can do and get the biggest bear around as fast as anybody in the country. Well, the truth of the matter was, the man had never killed a bear in his life. He just had the hide up on the wall to show that he possibly could do something. But bear season came around. They called his bluff, and sure enough, they all went up to the cabin that they had paid for. And when they got to the cabin, they said, now, you go out and get the first one. Then we'll go hunt. We want to find out if you can do what you say you can do. So the man couldn't possibly show face. It would have never done. So he put his gun over his shoulder, started walking down the path. And down the path just a ways, there was a bend in the road. And just after he made the bend, what do you think he came eyeball to eyeball with? You guessed it. One of the biggest bears in New Mexico. Well, he didn't know what to do. He'd never shot the gun in his life. It was just on the wall for brag, and he didn't know how to kill a bear. First thing came to his mind was throw the gun down, start around, turn around and run. And he did, just as hard as his 2 feet would carry him. He headed back to the cabin. Well, the closer he got to the cabin, he turned around and looked, and sure enough, the bear was taking chase. Well, he ran as hard as he possibly could, and the closer he got to the cabin, the closer the bear got to him. Now, just in front of the cabin door was a log. The little fellows laid it out there so that they could sit and chew the rag in the evening after they got through with their bear hunts. Well, the man didn't see the log. And when he got just to the front door of the cabin, which was wide open waiting for him to bring the bear back, he didn't see the log. His feet caught on it. He tripped and just sprawled out right on the ground in front of the door of the cabin. Well, the bear was going so fast behind him, he couldn't stop. The bear ran straight over the man, straight through the front door of the cabin. The fellow jumped up, closed the door, and said, "You hold that one. I'm going back after another one." Now, what I'm about to give tonight may seem just that unusual. But here's the way the story goes. And in order to conserve time, from here on is the truth, not a bear story. A number of months ago, I met a gentleman by the name of John Bergen. John Bergen is an outstanding businessman of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Quite well-to-do, and owns one of the largest nut importers of America, importing firms of America. John Bergen is very well respected in Minneapolis and is a very reputable individual, not a novice by any stretch of the imagination. He has political clout. And when he goes to Washington, even though Minneapolis and Minnesota are very liberal, even the liberals listen to him. John Bergen said to me some while back, "Lindsay, you need to know a gentleman by the name of Jonathan May." I said, "Who is Jonathan May?" I had never heard his name. He said, "Jonathan May is a citizen of England." And he said, "Jonathan May has traveled extensively worldwide, knows the issues, became quite knowledgeable through certain sources in the Council of Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission as to what the internationalists intend to do worldwide. It so disturbed him, and having certain Arab sources that he knew, he decided that he would attempt to counteract the game plan of the internationalist." Now, the internationalists are the ones that I attempt to describe in my latest book, Syndrome of Control, a group of power elite individuals, probably no more than 12 to 15 people, who hold the purse strings of every nation in the world and control most of the governments of the world through the control of their finances. He found out what these individuals were doing, and it so startled him until he decided that he would counteract what they were doing by establishing a worldwide Federal Reserve. You do recognize, of course, that the Federal Reserve System controls the money, the interest rate, the general economy, your lifestyle and mine, of every person in America. It is not an agency of the federal government. And so Jonathan May decided he would establish a worldwide Federal Reserve in order to help save certain nations. He got the Arabs to invest multi-amounts of money. I cannot name the exact figure. You'll hear him give some of it tonight himself in his own words. The Arabs had already said, "We will be involved." At the point that the Arabs were to deliver the funds in order to start this new creature, the internationalists in England found out about it. They threatened the life of Jonathan May and would not allow the Arabs to transfer the money into England for him to start this. At that point, Jonathan May felt that his life was in jeopardy, and he came to America. He did the wrong thing, of course, because the exact same powers that be that control England likewise control America. And in August of 1986, Jonathan May was arrested and put in federal prison in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on erroneous charges. John Bergen put me in touch with him by telephone because I was not allowed to go to the federal prison. Jonathan May, after numerous conversations and after a lot of persuasion, agreed to allow me to tape a conversation over the telephone, which you'll hear parts of tonight. In this conversation, he tells the game plan the timetable, and the inner manipulations of the power elite of the world as he knew it because of certain sources that he had. He gives his story as to what happened to him. Now, the 20 to 25 minute tape that we're going to be listening to in sections tonight, and an explanation with almost every statement, you're going to find it very unique, indifferent, different, startling, and possibly very, very disturbing in some senses, yet information-wise will probably be some of the most in-depth information that you or I have ever heard. The reason I say that is because I have been studying this issue for the past 6 years. I've traveled extensively nationwide. Last year, I was 7 months on the road without ever stopping and averaged 2 speaking engagements per day, averaged crisscrossing America every other week, and I felt that I knew most of the answers to what the boys were doing. After hearing Jonathan May and having him tell me some things that only top executives and the oil companies had told, which I had never told in public, I was willing to believe that his story was credible, because for the first time, Jonathan May put together some pieces of the puzzle that allowed me to see the complete total picture that I had never been able to put together since 1973 and 4, when I first sat in the board meetings with the oil company officials and found out that there positively was a plot for the control of America and the world, its finances and its people, by a group of power elite, and heard the top echelon oil companies officials saying it and telling about it in their own words. That was when I first became knowledgeable and disturbed, and since then I've tried to put all the pieces together, but there were some pieces that I never could get, because I did not have inroads into the CFR and the Trilateral Commission and the inner workings and manipulations of such organizations as the Bilderbergers and others. Jonathan May did have inroads into those organizations because of his worldwide travel and many contacts that he had, and put together the final pieces of the puzzle. Now, what I'm going to do that's so unique and different tonight, I have in my hand a tape recorder, which I'm hoping will be audible easily over the public address system, and I'm going to play portions of Jonathan May's explanation to you. Then I will stop and draw on the chalkboard the related subjects that will cause us to be able to understand the complete picture. And as far as I know, this is the first audience ever that this information has been given to. I have never given it before in public. I do not know what the repercussions of what I'm doing tonight will be. I do know that certain things are told on this cassette tape that the powers that be would be very startled if they knew they were known, because very few knew them except the top echelon themselves. Therefore, we will give a portion of the tape an explanation with the related material. So I'll begin at this time by playing just a portion, and then I'll go back for an explanation. Here goes Jonathan May in his own words, in his own voice, right from the federal jail in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we go, and then an explanation after a portion of his talk.
First of all, there are 13 families that effectively control the central banks of the hard currency countries. The hard currency countries are the countries whose currencies are called not to fluctuate as much as the other countries' currencies fluctuate. Those 13 families have the control of the policy making and decision making of the central banks of those countries.
All right, there are 13 families, he says, who controls the hard currency countries and the banks of the world. Those families are referenced in my book, To Seduce a Nation, and the 8 of them are listed, which are the owners of the majority of the stock of the regional banks of the Federal Reserve System. 13 families that control the currency of the world. Now, those are the families that basically manipulate gold prices every morning on the London Exchange. They're the 13 families who control the regional banks of the Federal Reserve. The 13 families that would control the currencies that are not allowed to fluctuate. You may note that the American dollar is the standard for all of the currency of the world. Wherever the American dollar goes, other nations are affected in relation to that dollar. Not only do these 13 families control the currency, but likewise control the banks in the leading nations of the world, the industrialized nation. With this, he goes on to say,
they all with one accord practice fractional reserve banking. The fractional reserve banking has allowed the central banks to permit the prime banks, whose owners and controllers are the same people as the central banks, to lend up to 26 units of currency for every one unit of currency they have, quote, on deposit.
Now, are you able to hear this? Are you picking it up out there? He has an English brogue, but I'm stopping every time because almost every statement is very in-depth. He says that all of the banks that are controlled by these 13 families practice fractional reserve banking, and they're allowed to loan up to 26 to 1 illustration. Now, this is perfectly legal in America. Fractional reserve banking is practiced by every lending institution in America and is a legal method of banking in this country. In order to explain fractional reserve banking, I need to do the following. Conrad, do you mind if I pick on you for a moment? You look like a typical banker. He's sitting there, he's kind of bald on top, and he has a nice, fancy leather coat on. His shoes are well polished, and his wife looks real neat sitting beside him with hair combed back and in a suit. And he looks like the typical local banker who would never do you wrong. And let's see, this gentleman sitting right down here, you look like the average individual who would like to deposit $1,000 into your friendly, smiling banker's bank, who would never do anything wrong for you. And so you have now you wouldn't dare do this, but let's just pretend for a moment that you would. You have $1,000, and you take it down to this gentleman's bank, he's the bank president, and you deposit $1,000 in his bank in a savings account, and it's a savings and loan. That savings and loan is allowed or is required by law to keep 5% in reserve and can loan out 95% of your $1,000, which means they can loan out $950. They loaned out that $950 to this gentleman sitting right over here who would like to build a room onto his house. So he takes the $950 down to the lumber supply place and buys that much lumber. Well, the lumber supply place does business with Bank B. This is Bank A over here. And Bank B is likewise required to keep 5%, which is $47.50, and can loan out $902.50 to this gentleman sitting right down here, who filters it back into the economy through the grocery store into Bank C, because the grocery store does business with Bank C. Bank C is required to keep 5%, which is $45.13, and can loan out $857.37. Now, that money is filtered back into the economy because it was loaned to this gentleman over here and filters back into Bank D. Bank D is required to keep $42.87 and can loan out $814.50. And you continue that scenario all the way down to zero. And, sir, here's what we come up with. Your $1,000 deposit in your friendly, smiling banker's bank who would never do you wrong, those bankers are allowed, using fractional reserve banking, to loan out $20,229.60. And it's being practiced by every lending institution in America. Oh, by the way, that doesn't even include the interest on the indebtedness. That's only the principal. Where does the interest come from? It's better known as the national debt. They turn up the presses faster and faster and faster every day in order to be able to pump more into the economy just to bolster up the fractional reserve banking alone. And Jonathan May says they're allowed to loan out $22 for every $1 that you put in their fractional reserve banking bank's bank. Now, 13 families control the hard currency of the world, practice fractional reserve banking, and, as Paul Harvey says, here's the rest of the story.
The initial
Now, you have possibly heard of Global 2000. Global 2000 is the point whereby they feel that they can basically control the world. And they have a plan. They have a timetable. They have dates set. And by a certain time, they plan to initiate Global 2000. And you heard him say that they visited Nigeria and started a number of years ago their Global 2000 monetary plan. And this is the story that I had never heard before, even though I had been with many of these top executives on the oil pipeline. But through his sources, he was able to dig out one of these keys, and here it is. It begins with Nigeria, a visit to Nigeria, and a promise that was made by the international bankers to that country. Now, he says that they visited Nigeria and said that they would give them $50 million across the board in cash with no repayment if they would be willing to double the price of light oil. Basic explanation is following. Only two nations in the world have light crude. Light crude oil is an oil that, as it comes out of the ground, it could almost be used in your automobile. It's the most valuable oil in the world. And according to the price of light crude, all other oil in the world is priced in accordance with the way those two nations price light crude. Whoever controls the price of light crude oil likewise controls all the oil prices in the world. Therefore, he said, they went to Nigeria, one of the two nations that has light crude, said, we'll give you this money if you will double the price of light crude. Now, the Arabs come into picture. Who today are sheikhs and sheiks, 30 to 40 years ago were nomads roaming the deserts riding camels. The international bankers found out that there was oil in their countries. They went and persuaded them to allow them to produce that oil by financing their oil fields. After they had financed their oil fields, they charged them usury for building their oil supply systems and their refineries. After the usury had been repaid because the Arabs became rich so quickly, back in those days, you were paying at the gas pump 30 cents per gallon for gasoline. First of all, the international bankers went to Nigeria, doubled the price of light crude. Then, unbeknownst to the Arabs, who had become wealthy overnight, knew nothing about international finance, had just been riding their camels out in the desert a few years ago, now they go to them and say, we will take the price of crude oil to any place you want it to go, as high as you would like it to go, if you will take a portion of the funds that you get from this new price rise that we're going to give you and deposit it in the international bankers' banks in New York. And you must deposit it in 30-year time certificates. Are you beginning to see now why 71, 72, 73, and 74, that prices of oil skyrocketed? It was because the international bankers who have the purse strings of the world knew that the increase in the price of oil that was going to the Arabs would come right back to their banks as 30-year time certificate deposits. Now, watch what they intended to do with those 30-year time certificate deposits, and you begin to get a picture of what's happening.
Assured us that Sheikh Imani and the other oil ministers did not know until late in the 70s, early in the 80s, that the controlling interests of the prime banks were
he says that the sheikhs of that day and time did not understand world finance. They did not know that the international bankers were taking them, and neither did they understand that America's major oil companies, such as Standard Oil, Atlantic Richfield, and the other major oil companies, were likewise controlled by the money of the international bankers' banks in New York. Therefore, the total picture of intake of profit on the part of the international bankers was all coming back to them. These Arabs, not understanding any of this international finance, fell for the plot of the international bankers, and little by little, the story becomes more bizarre. Now, he says that there was a joint stock trust. They're no longer legal in America, but they were set up in the 1800s, and it's under those joint stock trusts that the international bankers' banks in New York are allowed to operate, which other banks in America are not allowed to operate under. Do you wonder why? The Chase Manhattan Chemical Bank, J.P. Morgan's bank, and the others in New York are showing all-time record earnings, while around America, literally hundreds of banks per month are going broke. The reason is because they are operating under a grandfather clause of a joint bank trust, which is no longer legal, but because of the grandfather clause, they can operate in New York, that section of banks, and in so doing, take these finances and be able to manipulate with them both us and the Arabs. And with this, he continues. Now, he says that this joint stock trust that the banks operate under, the bank trust, controls both the Rockefeller Foundation, controls the Federal Reserve, and it's the method whereby they were able to gain control of the currency of the United States of America back in 1913 through the Federal Reserve, which no one else can do because those trusts are no longer allowed. Now, the Arabs did not realize that fractional reserve banking could be practiced by these banks. They did not understand banking. Remember, they had just been nomads on the deserts not too long ago. But through this, the international bankers were able to gain the control of the money of the Arab world, and the Arab world only received back the interest off of the money that they had put into the international bankers' banks under these 30-year time deposits. Now, through the funds that they had gained from the Arabs, which was directly related to the increase of oil prices, through a manipulation that had been made with the Arab world, and taking the price of your gasoline from 30 cents a gallon to $1.20 a gallon, now with this money coming back into the international bankers' banks, they take those funds, which originally came from you and from me, and invested them in the third world countries. You do remember, 15, 20 years ago, when the international bankers started investing in third world country loans. The countries that are going broke today, they invested back then. But they wanted those countries to go broke, and here is that part of the story.
Knowing and relying on the greed of the ministers of these nations to mishandle the money over the years to the extent where that manipulated greed has caused those countries to be in the position they're in.
Now, he says that they wanted those third world countries to go broke. You'll remember about the time that most of the third world countries were getting their independence, independence from England, independence from France, independence from America, and they were setting up their own governments. Now, he said at that point, the international bankers loaned them these large sums of money, which had come to them through the Arabs as a result of their oil prices. At this point, the international bankers wanted the third world countries to misuse those funds. They intended for them to go broke. It was part of the plan for those third world countries to squander the funds. Remember that the new leaders of these countries themselves had never governed any country before. They knew very little even about government. They had only been colonial countries under some other country. So the international bankers knew that their leaders would squander the money that was being given to them, which international bankers had taken from the Arabs and just from you originally through oil prices, and now here is where it goes.
In 1981, I was exposed to trying to help the Hunt brothers in Texas because they, with John Connolly, who was then the governor of Texas, who was also then the Undersecretary of the Treasury, had secretly tried to implement a new currency for Texas, since Texas is only a part of the Union, by treaty which is automatically renewed every year, but not...
Now here's a point that very few Americans, I think, you've ever heard of. Did you know that Texas is not a state by vote, such as other states, but a state by treaty? I see one head shaking here on the front. Texas is a state by treaty, not by vote. Now, you must know that Texas at one time became very wealthy, and independent individuals, such as the Hunt brothers, who years ago were nothing, but they were made rich overnight through the wealth of oil in Texas when oil was first struck and became so popular in the early days. Texas, being the place where the Hunt brothers lived, and John Connolly being the governor of Texas at one time, and you remember was in the limousine with John F. Kennedy when he was shot, and they tried to shoot Connolly also, but he went down the floorboard of the vehicle and lived through it to tell it. Well, there's a story behind why John Connolly was attempted to be assassinated. And while the Hunt brothers today are bankrupt, men that were multi-billionaires 15 years ago were some of the wealthiest men in the world, the Hunt brothers. And today, I was just in Dallas, Texas a few weeks ago, my wife and I, and an individual who was a friend of ours met with the Hunt brothers. They are in court right now in the process of attempting to stall off financial bankruptcy. They have been bankrupted by the internationalists. And the reason that the Hunt brothers are being broken today is because the internationalists knew what the Hunt brothers and Connolly, former governor of Texas, were trying to do. Texas, being a state by treaty, not by vote, any time that Texas wishes to, they cannot renew their treaty for that year and could legally secede from the Union. And the Hunt brothers and John Connolly knew that Texas had the ability of setting up their own country, having their own currency, and being solvent and not under the dictates of the Federal Reserve or the bureaucracy in Washington. And they were in the process of gaining a corner on the silver of the world in order to be able to finance a process whereby they could overcome the international bankers. And at that point, the Hunt brothers were broken, John Connolly was almost killed, and Texas, who could have been the only state in the Union to fulfill it, had some major problems. And today, Dallas and Fort Worth, Texas, you ride through the cities and you would bound declare that it was almost a ghost town in certain areas. Storefronts are closed. People have moved out of $150,000, $200,000 homes. The internationalists became so angry at what Texas had done until they broke the back of the oil industry and the major oil producers of Texas, and it was all by a design plan, and we go further.
Automatically renewed every year. It's become a tradition, obviously, that it's renewed every year, but it's actually not renewed every year. And the intention was that Texas was going to create its own money. The Hunts were in partnership with the Shah of Iran, a German bank and an Austrian bank, responsibly because they had one man doing both buying and selling on the same floors of all the exchanges and work got out. And the result of that was that the German banker was murdered. You may remember the Baader-Meinhof terrorists at the time who only actually ever murdered one person. Although a lot of industrialists were captured and held to ransom and various other things. Only one actually man, which was a banker, ever got murdered.
The Chauvelin, the Hunt brothers of Texas, and a banker were attempting to do this. He said that one was killed, the Chauvelin was deposed, and the Hunt brothers today are filing for bankruptcy. You see what the internationalists can do whenever you attempt to thwart their plan.
That banker that was a partner of the Hunts, the Austrian banker, was so badly beaten up, you'll never get out of a mental institution. And the Hunts, you know what happened to them, they're virtually bankrupt today, despite the fact that they had about 16 billion in worth at the time. The Shah was perfectly healthy when he left Iran. He was only declared sick when he arrived in America, held in, quote, protective custody, unquote, in U.S. military bases.
Now, he says that the Shah of Iran was in perfect health when he left Iran. When he came here, they saw to it that he died. You know, it can very easily be done by chemical and germ warfare. The rest of the story of the deposing of the Shah of Iran is dared to be printed in my latest book, Syndrome of Control. Congressman George Hansen tells the story. You'll remember that Congressman Hansen was in the House of Representatives in Washington. He heard what was happening in Iran and wanted to investigate. Congress would not let him go. This story, by the way, is told minute by minute, hour by hour, in this book for the first time in copyrighted form. You'll want to get it and read it for yourself. He went to Iran, paid his own airline ticket to go over. When he got there, the Khomeini gave him an audience. The Khomeini said, "We don't want these hostages any more than you want us to have them." That wasn't what we were told by the media, was it? Khomeini said, "I would like to give you one half of the hostages to take home with you tomorrow morning if you will promise to start an investigation into the relationship between the Shah of Iran, Chase Manhattan Bank, Henry Kissinger, and President Carter." Congressman Hansen called back to someone in Congress whose name he mentions in this book and says, "I can bring half of the hostages home tomorrow. Would you like me to?" He said, "I'll call you back tomorrow and tell you." Would you believe? America held hostage while he says, "We'll call you back tomorrow and tell you whether you can bring them home or not." The next day, the call came back. Congressman Hansen was told, "Get on the next airplane. Come home. Don't bring any hostages with you. Do not do any negotiating. You have no right to speak on the part of the Congress of the United States of America, even though you are a congressman. Get home immediately." When he came back, he found out that it was documented, by the way, and placed in the congressional record. He found that President Carter knew that the hostages were going to be taken. He knew approximately how long they were going to be kept. He knew that they were there for a reason. And the release of the hostages was not negotiated by the State Department of the United States of America. The release of the hostages in Iran was negotiated by a negotiator of Chase Manhattan Bank in New York. And the hostages were kept, and America held hostage while the bankers got the Shah's money in their banks before he was killed, and in turn got much of the money of Iran. And do you wonder that Iran is mad at us today? After the shenanigans we pulled to get their money into Chase Manhattan Bank so it could remain solvent and be one of the wealthiest institutions in the world today, that is what Jonathan May is speaking of, and we continue.
Treated and became progressively worse and ultimately was shipped off to die. Not before all his assets had been frozen, which doesn't make much sense until you realize the ploy of the globalists. That's something of a red herring, but it's interesting. In 1983, we became aware of the fact that a group of very, very quiet bank holding companies, which are authorized under Regulation Y,
right. It says that they formed a group of bank holding companies. The international bankers' banks did. And the reason they formed them was so that they could not be held responsible, so that Chase Manhattan Chemical Bank and J.P. Morgan's bank could not be held responsible for the money that the Arabs had been put into their banks. They formed bank holding companies who in turn would loan out the money to the third world countries. Knowing that the third world countries were going to go broke after they had already destroyed the Shah, had the money in their banks, loaning out exorbitant amount of money, determining they were going broke, and letting the bank holding companies hold these loans. Knowing what was going to happen when these third world countries went broke.
Please turn the...